by the time it arrived in the South, the game of football had already had ascribed to it these meanings steeped in masculinity and martial virtues. Many of the first players were younger brothers of Civil War veterans, later sons of Civil War veterans. And there was this feeling that they needed to prove themselves as the men who'd gone before them had.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. This time of year is a great time to be a college sports fan. College football is nearing the end of its regular season, with the best teams fighting for a playoff spot and others angling for a bowl game. And overlapping that is the start of college basketball season, which is an especially big deal here in North Carolina, as the North Carolina Tar Heels welcome a new coach, Hubert Davis, and the Duke Blue Devils say goodbye to the legendary Mike Krzyzewski, now coaching his final year. Author Ed Southern has thought a lot about how and why college sports have hooked us so deeply, especially here in the South. He's written a book about it called Fight Songs. It covers a lot of territory, how he and his wife fell in love, how COVID has affected all our lives, how he grew up rooting for one of the losingest football teams in America, the Wake Forest Demon Deacons, although this might be their best season ever, which has made Ed very happy. But at its core, Fight Songs is a history lesson, how college football gained such a grip on the Deep South, and why college basketball has a nearly equal grip on North Carolina. Ed and I talked recently as part of a virtual book launch event sponsored by Park Road Books, the great independent bookstore here in Charlotte. By the end, we get a little metaphysical and talk about whether our society even deserves the joy of sports right now. Here's our conversation. You cover a lot of territory in this book, and I know that it sort of didn't intend to be that way. And so could you just start by talking a little bit about the idea you had at the beginning of Fight Songs and sort of how it changed over time?
At first, what became the book Fight Songs was going to be a short, lighthearted, I hoped, funny little essay, exploring the weirdness of being a lifelong Wake Forest football fan married to an Alabama football fan during the decade of Nick Saban's dominance, when the Crimson Tide became the Crimson Dementor of college football. You know, for those of you who aren't football fans, aren't familiar with kind of the hierarchy of college football, Wake Forest, despite some remarkable success in the last few years, is still sort of everyone's go-to shorthand for a program that no one cares about. Wake Forest is by far the smallest school in the Power Five conferences, and I think still all time has the losingest record in the Power Five. If any of you are classic rock fans, you may know the old Steely Dan song, Call Me Deacon Blues, whose chorus is, they have a name for the winners in the world. I want a name when I lose. They call Alabama the Crimson Tide. Call me Deacon Blues. And as I write about in the book, it turns out they weren't even aware of Wake Forest when they write that. It's just a coincidence, which somehow is even more of a Wake Forest football situation than if they had been intentionally insulting us. So I started to do that and began to ask questions about, well, how did it get this way? How did it get to where, you know, the state of Alabama shuts down for the Iron Bowl, the annual game between Auburn and Alabama, whereas North Carolina used to shut down for quarterfinal Friday of the ACC men's basketball tournament, but doesn't anymore? And why is there a difference both in the sport and the season, but also a difference in the verb tense, you know, that Alabama still has this tradition of coming to a standstill for the Iron Bowl? ACC tournament doesn't even have quarterfinal Friday anymore. You know, what happened and what does that mean for those of us who live here? While I was working on that, and had been talked into expanding, you know, my original essay into a book length manuscript. 2020 came along, and some of the questions about our history and our cultural identity that I was looking at sort of came roaring to the forefront in a lot of the issues that we were facing last year in terms of public health, in terms of attitudes towards government, and then, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement of the summer, of course, with questions of race.
So there's a lot of threads to pull on there. And the first one I want to pull on is sort of the that football thread, especially college football, which the South has dominated for years now. But as you point out in the book, we in the South kind of came late to college football, even though it has come to mean, you know, as you mentioned in the book, the SEC has this slogan, "It just means more." And that's pretty accurate, I think. How did the South come to this so late? Why did that happen? And why do you think it matters so much now?
What we now think of as college football was more or less, it's not entirely accurate to say it was invented. It kind of developed in the years following the Civil War. And it began in the Northeast. You know, just last year we celebrated, 2 years ago, we celebrated the 150th anniversary of the game between Rutgers and Princeton that is generally seen as the first college football game, even though to us it would have looked a lot more like a soccer game. You know, it stayed in the Northeast and very slowly trickled out to the rest of the country. Didn't really start getting into the South until the 1880s. And that was because the South was still, to a great degree, isolated culturally and economically following Reconstruction. Some of that was the South's own doing. But eventually it did get down here and was taken up fairly quickly, first by colleges and later by, you know, when they started this newfangled idea called public schools, you know, they began to field football teams. And by the time it arrived in the South, the game of football had already had ascribed to it these meanings steeped in masculinity and martial virtues. You know, it was played, again, it started in 1869, was the Princeton-Rutgers game. So you're 4 years removed from the end of the Civil War. Many of the first players were younger brothers of Civil War veterans, later sons of Civil War veterans. And there was this feeling that they needed to prove themselves as the men who'd gone before them had. There also was this, Professor Andrew Doyle of Winthrop University, who was nice enough to talk to me about the book, there was going on what he described as a crisis of masculinity, because with increasing industrialization and commercialization, you had more and more men working outside the home for the first time. And leaving their sons at home with their mothers. And so they were, well, how are we going to teach our boys how to be real men? And football became their answer, their way to do that, rightly or wrongly. So when this sport that is already seen as, you know, a preparation, if not a substitute for war, and an expression of masculinity comes to a South whose colleges are populated by the sons of the elite. You know, these are the sons, you know, of people who could afford to send their children to college. And they're still smarting from the loss of the Civil War. And this sport arrives with these ready-made meanings. Of course they embraced it. You know, not just to refight the Civil War, as is, you know, that's called kind of the cliched answer. And it's cliched because it's not wrong. But also because there was this, you know, long before the Civil War, the South had this culture, this tradition of honor and shame, of dominance established through demonstrative play, of, you know, what W.J. Cash called, you know, the chip on the shoulder brag of a boy, where, you know, any slight had to be answered. You know, it was like football had been ready-made for all of these complex cultural issues that the South had brewing.
Another part of that I had not thought about much until I read this book, you know, it's obvious that football has all these sort of war metaphors, and the sport itself is got sort of based on violence. There's no other sport really where your job is to knock somebody else down. But the thing that I had not thought about much until you brought it up was how much it's tied into, it's sort of a game about land. You know, you move into the opponent's territory. And if you think about what a touchdown is, it's when you've claimed all the field for yourself. There's no other sport I think of there where that sort of thing is so ingrained in the way the game's played. And I think you tie that in some ways to the people who settled here in the South.
Sure. I mean, yeah, as I say in the book, you know, football is a game of land, of territory that is literally measured and marked and chained. You know, I mean, you have chain gang on the sideline that you know, measures a first down. And I had never really thought about it in those terms until, and I noticed my brother among the panelists, I have to give him a shout out. He and some of our friends got me started watching soccer, which I didn't really care about until I was an adult, and noticed what a fluid game it is. I mean, you're trying to move the ball towards the opponent's goal, but you're not claiming territory as you go the way that you are in football. And so that really got me to thinking about, you know, the South in particular. I mean, the United States as a whole does. This is by no means unique to the South. You know, you make your way by claiming your land. But in the South, unlike in the Northeast, it was up until really the 1950s, if not even a little bit later, an almost purely agricultural economy. And, you know, certainly in the antebellum era, the only way for a man to gain status in society was to own land. You know, you had to be a landowner. Of course, in the early days of the Republic, you had to be a landowner to vote. And again, along comes a game like what American football had evolved into by the time it came south, where it's no longer the fluid back and forth game that soccer and rugby are. You know, it's a game of marching down the field, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, 10 yards in a first down at a time. And again, it was almost tailor-made for the concerns, the cultural concerns of the South.
Much of what we consider the Deep South, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, those areas are football country. Other parts of the South, especially North Carolina, are considered basketball country. One thing I didn't know before I read your book is that the Atlantic Coast Conference, ACC, you know, the pinnacle of college basketball, started out as a football conference. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe how and why that happened, and then what shifted to make basketball sort of king here.
Well, it's funny because I didn't know that until I started writing this book and reading up on it. I would have assumed that the ACC had always been a basketball conference. The founding seven schools of the ACC all had been members of the Southern Conference, which had become a humongous league, stretching from West Virginia University all the way down to the Citadel. And it was becoming unwieldy, and it was marred by, the biggest football scandal involving the Southern Conference was the reigning conference champion, William & Mary, was found to have altered the grades of some of its football recruits. And when the president of the school brought this before they don't call it the board of trustees, I think they call it the board of visitors, they said, well, so what? And wanted to get rid of the president, not the football coach.
Boy, that sounds familiar.
Right. Except William & Mary, you know, that's the strange part of it. And in fact, right before the ACC was founded, the conference champion in football of the Southern Conference was Washington and Lee, you know, which is Division III now. And in response to this, several of the leaders of the Southern Conference wanted to scale back football. And they, in fact, imposed a bowl ban. They said, okay, none of our member schools are going to accept invitations to play in bowl games, which even then was worth a lot of money. Not the money it's worth now, but a lot of money. And two of the schools in particular, Clemson and the University of Maryland, had really built themselves using football as a way to attract interest, attract fans, attract booster donations. And so Curly Bird at Maryland, Frank Howard at Clemson said, no, somebody invites us to a bowl, we're going. And if you don't like it, kick us out. So the two of them and the University of South Carolina were fed up with the Southern Conference. Meanwhile, the Big Four in North Carolina of Wake Forest, Duke, Carolina, and State were very worried about the lack of what we would call now the lack of institutional control, the lack of academic control caused by being in such a huge conference, you know, with those, football factories like William & Mary and Washington and Lee involved. So they thought maybe we should leave the Southern Conference, set up our own conference. They end up coming together with Clemson, Maryland, South Carolina. They meet in Greensboro in 1953, formally withdraw from the Southern Conference, decide to set up a new conference, call it the Atlantic Coast. You know, football was their main concern. Basketball was an afterthought, even though college basketball was already becoming more popular thanks to NC State hiring Everett Case to take over its basketball program in the 1940s. And, he began the Dixie Classic Tournament, which became hugely popular and kind of an obsession in the state. And in response to Case's dominance, the other schools started amping up their basketball programs. UNC went out and hired Frank McGuire away from St. John's. Duke came very close to hiring Red Auerbach. Wake Forest already had a good basketball coach in Murray Greason. He hired an assistant who had played for Red Auerbach on the Celtics named Bones McKinney. And so you have the Big Four basketball teams getting better and better and better. The event that's credited with really, not doing it overnight, but turning the ACC into a basketball league was Carolina winning the 1957 national championship. Because not only did they win the national championship at a time when, the South was rarely number one in anything that you wanted to be proud of, but they won it in two straight triple overtime thrillers. And they won it in two straight televised triple overtime thrillers, thanks to the vision of C.D. Chesley, who, had been working in television broadcasting, which was an infant medium at the time, had the foresight. I think, people would want to watch these games, made a deal to broadcast the games through stations in, it was just three markets. I think it was Greensboro, Charlotte, and Raleigh, Charlotte, and Wilmington. And then that was the semifinal. And then for the final, he added two more. And so North Carolinians got to watch the University of North Carolina, win two classic games to win a national championship. And at that point, you could say, the die was cast that, and especially since the ACC kept not winning as much in football, gradually, over the course of the next few years, North Carolina becomes a college basketball state. That becomes the sport that we set our seasons by.
When we come back, Ed Southern discusses sports as a reward for a functioning society and whether we've earned that reward lately.
Are we functioning well? I don't see how we can make that argument.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to today's episode, I want to take just a second to let you know about the treasures we've got in the Southbound archives. We've done more than 100 episodes now. By my rough calculations, you could drive all the way from Charlotte to San Francisco, existing on nothing but Southbound episodes, plus the occasional snack. So there's bound to be something you love. Interested in music? I've done episodes with Ben Folds, Rhiannon Giddens, Anthony Hamilton, Patterson Hood, and many, many others. Comedy? How about Roy Wood Jr., Fortune Feimster, and Nate Bargatze? Sports? Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Paul Feinbaum. Fashion? Andre Leon Talley and Billy Reid. Plus so many others, from chef Vivian Howard, to writer Rick Bragg, to actress Brooklyn Decker. I also talked to many Southerners who might not be as famous, but are doing important work, from whale watcher Clay George to hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley. You can dive into the archives by following Southbound on any of your favorite podcast providers or by going to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. Enjoy the journey. And now, back to my conversation with Ed Southern. I want to drag all this into the present now. All this history that you've talked about. Now we're in a place where this is, I'm sure, true outside the South as well, but certainly in the South. The chances are very good that the highest paid state employee in football states is going to be the football coach at the state university. In North Carolina, maybe the basketball coach somewhere. These schools have become, as you kind of talk about a lot in your book, they've become not just universities, but they've become brands. And in fact, the players starting this year who can get money for their name and likeness, the players themselves have sort of become brands. And it's become this huge business where the TV contracts are like the GDP of small countries. And at the same time, it's rooted in very ordinary stuff like your family and my family and so many millions of other families watching on TV together, people who may never go to a game. And I guess I'm wondering kind of what your ambivalence level is about all this. I know everybody who cares about college sports, who follows it, has some level of ambivalence about what it's become and the bigness of it while still loving it. Where are you on that scale these days?
Through the roof. I mean, really, it's something that I grapple with on all sorts of fronts. You know, my love for college sports and especially college football, with the inequities that it creates or encourages or sometimes disguises. You know, aside from, you know, the physical damage that's done to so many of the players, you know, that in and of, yeah, it's funny, you know, before last year when we talked about, you know, playing safely, you meant head injuries. You know, how can you play while avoiding concussion? You know, then last year it's how do you play safely while avoiding COVID? And it really, you know, the ambivalence is the right word, because, you know, while there are an awful lot of bad things about college sports and particularly college football and men's basketball, there are a lot of great things about them too. I mean, and you can't deny one or the other. You know, you just have to kind of find a balance. God only knows how many Tua Tagovailoa jerseys were sold in the state of Alabama, and he never saw a dime from any of them. You know, I could go out and print, you know, well, Bryce Young is the Alabama quarterback now. I could go down to a screen printing store and print up, you know, 50 t-shirts with Bryce Young's, you know, name, image, likeness, number, and go stand on a street corner in Tuscaloosa on game day and make a nice chunk of change selling those. Bryce Young himself can't do the same, or couldn't do the same thing, until finally now we're going to let these players get just a very small taste of the, you know, like you say, you know, the multi-billion dollar industry and economy that is college sports.
A big part of this book, of course, is sort of a love story of how you met and married your wife, who, you know, and you're sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum, especially when it comes to football. As you said, Wake may have the worst record of any, you know, major college football team. And Alabama, I'm not sure if they have the best record, but they certainly are the preeminent college football team and have been for decades. Do you think that you and your wife sort of see the world differently in other ways because she grew up rooting for this team that won all the time and you grew up rooting for this team that lost all the time?
We certainly see the world in some different ways. I can't say for certain that it was caused by, you know, her growing up an Alabama fan, where you have this tradition of victory and this expectation that, you know, we're going to have the best team in the country. And if we don't, something's gone wrong and needs to be fixed. As opposed to me, you know, growing up seeing Wake Forest go through an entire season winning one game. She tends to see challenges where I tend to see threats. And, you know, it gets a similar reaction, but it comes from very different places. Although that may be because she's a younger child and I'm an oldest child, rather than our difference in rooting interests.
One of the quotes you mentioned in the book is something, quote that I love from the moment I heard it. It was kind of in the middle of COVID. This relief pitcher for the Washington Nationals, Sean Doolittle, somebody asked him about COVID and how its relationship to sports. And he said, sports are the reward for a functioning society. And the question I want to ask out of that is, do you think we're a functioning society right now? And I guess kind of the bigger question is, do we deserve to have sports right now because of the way we're acting in the rest of our society?
You know, I drove over here from Park Road Shopping Center to get ready for this, and everybody obeyed all the traffic lights that we came to. And so I guess I have to say that we are still a functioning society. Are we functioning well? I don't see how we can make that argument. And certainly not functioning as well as a nation with the resources of the United States ought to be. You know, I have a daughter in kindergarten, and her second week in school, there was a school shooting at the high school less than a mile from her elementary school. And so her school handled it beautifully, as that's the wrong word to describe the situation, but they handled it as well as could be asked for. And they went into lockdown, and they the principal came over the intercom and said, you know, we're asking everyone to stay in their classrooms. We're going to lock the doors in order to keep you safe. Well, there just happened to be thunderstorms rolling through our town that afternoon. And so our daughter came home with the assumption that, oh, they locked the doors to keep us safe from the thunderstorms. And then last week, we're getting her ready to go off to school, and we tell her, here, you need to take your jacket because it's supposed to rain this afternoon. And she rolls her eyes and says, great, they're going to lock the doors again. And, you know, it was funny, and it was heartbreaking, and it was so, so sad that, you know, she's 4 weeks into kindergarten, and this is something that she's already having to deal with. And so, again, I don't know that you can say that we are a well-functioning society when we can tell stories like that one. Do we deserve sports? I guess in order to not be a hypocrite, I have to say that we do, because I've been watching sports. And, you know, again, I'm a lukewarm soccer fan at best, and have come to it fairly recently. But when the Bundesliga started playing on TV last, what was it, April, and they were the first sport back on TV, you better believe I was in front of my screen. I don't know that we ought to let sports consume us as much as we have. And I wrote in the book, and I sometimes think, you know, again, maybe the second edition, I'll elaborate on this, that I found myself much less, I didn't follow, you know, even though the ACC played sort of almost a full schedule of games last season, I found myself not following them as much. You know, I listened and watched a lot of Atlanta Braves games, but I wasn't really following the standings. I found myself not caring as much about the overall picture, the overall arc. And I think it was because I had other things to worry about, you know, and I almost feel like sports was in a healthier place in my own psyche. While the rest of my psyche was completely falling apart, at least I had sports, you know, in a good place for that time period. So I don't, it's a really hard question to answer.
Sports is not just a reward, as Ed Southern talked about there at the end. It's a proxy, an outlet for many of us to let loose with emotions that we're too smart or too embarrassed to express in our regular lives. You can scream with joy or weep with despair or cuss out the ref with words your mama never taught you. And in the context of sports, it's sort of normal. Sports give us a day pass to that more primal version of ourselves. It's weird, but understandable, that some of us now have the instinct to dissect a sport rather than just roll around in it. The sports world is now full of amateur general managers who memorize contract numbers like kids who used to memorize batting averages. That tracks, I guess, in a nation where people now work more at keyboards than they do in fields or factories. Ed Southern's book reminded me, among other things, that football took hold among white Southerners who desperately needed to prove they could win at something after they lost so decisively in the Civil War. A sport filled with military terms and based on acquiring territory, well, that's a proxy of its own. Why have Alabama and Georgia and LSU and Florida been so good at football for so long? The Southeastern Conference had that commercial not long ago that said, it just means more. That's right. But why does it just mean more? That's not a commercial. It's a documentary. I want to add one last thing before we go to the credits today. This is the last episode of Southbound that will have the guiding hand of Joni Deutsch. Joni and I started at WFAE about the same time, and she's been my closest collaborator on Southbound, from deciding on guests, to helping with promos, to editing the interviews. If you like this podcast, Joni is a lot of the reason why. She also created and hosted her own podcast, Amplifier, and was a force behind all of WFAE's other podcasts. Joni is leaving WFAE to go on to what I'm sure are bigger and better things. But her voice will always be a part of this podcast and this station. Even when she's not here, you'll be able to hear her voice. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.